Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for everyone who loves the Bible. I'm Rachel Wren, Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies at Trinity Lutheran Seminary at Capital University.
And I'm Tim McNinch. I teach Hebrew Bible at Christian Theological Seminary. And we are still in the midst of our, what are we calling it, apocalypse now?
Right.
Hebrew Bible scholars read Revelation.
Yeah.
Since the lectionary does not have Old Testament readings during the season of Easter, we have been following through in reading through the book of Revelation, which is, 98% Old Testament anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. I mean, you really, to understand it, you not only got to have like a good handle on Greco-Roman politics and society, but you also really got to know your Hebrew Bible.
So for this week, we're jumping to the end of the book.
Yeah.
To Revelation chapter 21, the first few verses there. This is for May 18th. Mm-hmm. Rachel's going to kind of take the lead on this, but before you jump into it, Rachel, let me just say to our listeners and viewers out there, we say something about this in our outro each time, but I wanted to say up front here that for the last, month or two, we've been uploading videos of our podcast to a new YouTube channel. And we would invite you all to help us out. If you're watching this on our website or just listening in your podcast app, to actually go to YouTube, find First Reading, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Yeah. That will help the algorithm push this out even further into the world and help us maybe reach some people who haven't seen or heard us before. So that would be really helpful if you could take care of that little bit of marketing for us.
Yeah. Come alongside, accompany us that way. I have all of these like phrases that my kids walk around the house saying now, like, share, subscribe, smash that like button, please subscribe.
Yes.
So, all of us.
We are aspiring influencers.
Oh my
right?
goodness. No, thank you. But we are aspiring to beat the algorithm a little bit. So if you could help us.
That's right. And we haven't really invested as a podcast in marketing and advertising and that sort of thing. We're really relying on word of mouth to spread what it is that we're doing. So folks out there, if you could do us the favor of going to YouTube and subscribing to the channel, that'll help us out quite a bit.
Awesome. Yeah.
All right. With that, let's jump into Revelation 21. The end of all things.
The almost end, the penultimate end.
All right.
Yeah. So this is one of my favorite texts from the book of Revelation. It's not quite my favorite. You get to tackle that one next week. Revelation 22 verses 1 through 5. You lucky duck. There's just some incredible imagery in there. But this is still a really, really good one. And actually, some of the things that I love about it are things that we already talked about in our podcast episode last week, because there's some resonance between Revelation 7 and Revelation 21. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, let me bring us up to speed a little bit here, because last week and the couple weeks before, we were kind of moseying our way through the book of Revelation. Like we had Revelation 1 first week, Revelation 5 second week. Revelation 7, this is kind of a good pace. We're hitting all the highlights. So I was able to fill you in, dear listeners, on what we missed by skipping over Revelation 6. I'm not going to do that today. Last week, where we discussed Revelation 7, now we have jumped all the way to Revelation 21.
Really, nothing happens in the interim.
Well, that's the thing. It's sort of like we skipped the whole thing. Like Revelation 7 is just when it starts to get good. You've got four horsemen of the apocalypse. You've got the martyrs with their robes washed in the blood of the lamb. And now we just miss everything else that happens. Now, I don't exactly hate that. I mean, the Bible person in me does, but like, I get it. We've got Easter. It's a short season. If you're going to do the book of Revelation, then, you kind of have to do beginning, little, middle, and then end. Mm-hmm. And the other reason I don't hate it is because Revelation is not one of those books you want to skimp on for your people. There are so many layers of interpretation of the book of Revelation. It's not even an onion. It's like a baklava. Like you've got layers, then you've got honey poured on it. There's some nuts in there, maybe a lot of nuts if we're talking the book of Revelation. And to peel back each one of those layers, it takes a lot and it demands a lot. So if you're going to do this, I would say do like a summer series on the book of Revelation and then walk a little bit slower through it. So, that's just my my two cents there.
Yeah.
So to that end, instead of filling you in on everything that happened in the past 14 chapters, I'm just going to remind you of a couple of things that we said right at the beginning of this series that you need to keep in mind when reading the book of Revelation. And it's especially important when you're reading the end. So first of all, it's a genre of literature called apocalyptic literature. Apocalypse does not mean end of the world. It just means unveiling in Greek, apocalypsis, or revelation, hence the name of the book, Revelation. Mm-hmm. It does not mean atom bomb zombie apocalypse end of the world. So that's point number one. Point number two is that apocalyptic literature is not just Revelation. It's also parts of Daniel, the Dead Sea Scrolls, even certain gospel chapters like Mark 13. It was a type of literature that arose in the times between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, that kind of 500-year span. And it arose out of a really specific historical situation. The situation of times of turmoil and trauma, national turmoil and trauma, and really, really bad turmoil and trauma. Like, this is not something that just kind of comes out on a Tuesday. It comes out when stuff has really hit the fan, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Point number three, out of those situations of turmoil and trauma, apocalyptic literature, like Revelation, arose for a certain purpose. Number one, it was trying to make sense of vast, meaningless national suffering. That's one of the main goals of the book of Revelation, to say, I know it feels like everything is hopeless, but it's not. So hang in there. Making sense, making meaning. Two, it was created to give people hope in the midst of what felt like a hopeless situation. And three, it was created to call people to God and away from the really death-dealing practices of the world around them. Okay, couple more points. Number four, it's not actually a prediction of the future, though it has been read that way for literally centuries. Like, it's not even just a dispensationalism thing. It's been read that way almost since we started interpreting it. We'll talk about that, I think, in this last series, because there's these, you know, I'm coming soon phrases that make it seem like, well, shouldn't we read it that way? Okay, so even shorter summary of the summary. Apocalyptic literature, literary genre, arose from turmoil and trauma. Purpose was to make sense of suffering, give people hope, and call them to God. If you want it even shorter, meaning, hope, and relationship. Those are the three goals of the book of Revelation. Would you say that's accurate to how you read it, Tim?
Oh, yeah. All of that stuff about what apocalyptic literature is and does, I find that I have a difficult time holding on to that.
Yeah.
And I often forget it. Yeah. And I need that reminder about, oh, yeah, this is a specific type of literature, to help me to come to terms with what I'm seeing on the page,
right,
which is pretty fantastic. And all I would add is that the flip side to all of this is that by understanding the literary genre and how it fits into a historical context doesn't take away any of the fantasticalness.
No.
Is that a word?
Yeah, it is now.
Of this literature, it still smacks you in the face with how weird and strange and wonderful and mysterious it is. All of that doesn't get explained away by saying, well, this is how it works.
No.
You still get that experience of encountering this type of literature.
No, I think that's a really helpful point, that me calling it a genre of literature does not make it any less the word of God. I think that's a really great point. So what we miss in the previous 14 chapters is the way that the author of Revelation, this dude named John, really draws out this meaning-giving, this hope, and this relationship using a cyclical format of smacking us with the law in Technicolor. If you're, you know, a Lutheran, you know what I mean. What bad things can happen if we give our allegiance to wealth, status, etc., rather than God. And then once we've been kind of smacked in the face, bringing us up to God's throne room to give us hope. It's a cycle that the book goes through over and over and over again. What we get here at the end is a final push into and through that glorious, shining hope. Okay, so at this point, John has been shown a vision of the ultimate hope, a new heaven and a new earth. So even if you think that all of the stuff that came before this isn't going to quite solve your problems, isn't going to quite give meaning to your suffering, guess what? It's all going to be brand new. Like, this is the biggest gift of the book of Revelation. He sees Jerusalem coming down as like a detail perfect, as detail perfect as a bride on her wedding day. Like everything down to the blades of grass has been to with love and care and hope that it will be received with that same sense of love and care and appreciation. At this moment, John hears a loud voice, which is not unusual in the book of Revelation. It starts with a voice, but look real quick at where it's coming from. It's coming from the throne. Now, I did some quick research on this. I could be wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, there's only three times that the one in the center of the throne speaks in the book of Revelation. It's in Revelation 19, verse 5, calling for praise to God. So I'm going to assume this is Jesus here, because Revelation 7:17 says that the Lamb is at the center of the throne. So again, there's a Trinitarian kind of understanding. But here, the one on the throne speaks not just once, but twice in this chapter. And I just want to read what he says, because it is so amazing. See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away.
Mm.
Can we just pause for a second on how incredibly beautiful that is?
Yeah, it is.
It's just gorgeous. Yeah, okay. Pause done. All right. So gorgeous. And remember, this is Jesus speaking. And the only other time he's spoken has been to call for praise to God. So when he speaks here, it's just this pure good news proclamation. And I'll kind of walk us through it a little bit. So first of all, see, the home of God is among mortals. Now, what we have heard from the Hebrew Bible up to this point, really outside of some texts in Isaiah, is that the home of God is among Israel, that God tabernacled among Israel in the wilderness, that God dwelt in the ark in the temple, again, among Israel in Jerusalem. And there's an expansion here. So in this new heaven and this new earth, God's home is not just among Israel, but among mortals, among these flimsy little fleshy things that, you know, mess up on the left and then die on the right. Somehow that's where God is making the divine home in this new place. And then the next part, he will dwell with them. What, of course, we have here is a callback to when God came down on Sinai and attempted for the first time to dwell amongst mortals. And somehow the new creation that the Lamb has provoked allows God to dwell amongst humanity and for no one to get burned. And I'll just real quick, in the Greek here, the Greek even says tabernacle. So God will make his tabernacle with the people and will tabernacle, verb form, with them. Like, this isn't even a call back. It's just an explicit call. Like, God will tabernacle amongst us once again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. The Greek word is basically a cognate to the Hebrew Shekinah.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Great point. So, and to that point, the next, I mean, it's sort of like repetition, but that's in all of the Johannine literature. It's repetition and then sort of like, yes, and. It's kind of like improv. So, home of God is among mortals. Yes, and he will dwell with them. Yes, and they will be his peoples. And I just want to draw your attention here that this is plural. This is peoples, not just people. This is all humans. And I would even expand it to say all life on earth belongs to God in this new creation. Now, there are some ancient manuscripts that read people singular, but I say poo-poo on them. So that's my official scholarly take on this.
Yes. Great text criticism there.
Thank you. Yes. You can quote me. and then these couple last lines here, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. We talked about this one extensively last week, and it's Hebrew Bible references in Isaiah and other places. So I won't repeat all of that. I'll just pause and say, for a homiletical moment, it could be really fun to ask your congregation, who are the people who wipe tears from eyes? I'm thinking parents. Grandparents. I'm thinking caregivers. I'm thinking dear friends who are comforting us in our grief. I mean, there's a real deep intimacy in this kind of human relations that we don't let people touch our faces.
Right.
You know, it'd be really awkward if someone I didn't know very well tried to wipe a tear away from my face. And yet it's a really, really beautiful image of wanting to offer comfort and offer acknowledgement. You know, it's not necessarily to say you shouldn't be crying, but it's to say, I see them, you know, I see those tears. So it's a really beautiful acknowledgement here as well.
Yeah. Such an intimate image, right? Yeah. I mean, I could imagine if I were rewriting this, that the one on the throne could say, stop crying.
Yeah, right.
But this isn't a command. No. This is an approaching and an intimate encounter of wiping away the tears, which is, wow, just really powerful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful image. And I think it's one of the reasons why this is so common at funerals, of course. And then the next line, death will be no more. And one of my favorite, you know, poems, death, thou shalt die. But again, with John, it's always yes and. Yes, death will be no more, and mourning and crying and pain will be no more. So again, it's not a command to stop. It's just saying all of the reasons that have been provoking this painful reaction out of you, they will just, you know, they'll just be gone. I am making all things new. I'm struck as well by the fact that if you look in the text, this is poetry. You know, when Jesus speaks here, it's not just like a rant. It's actually formatted as poetry. So there's just this awareness, and I don't know if this is a preaching moment, but perhaps it can inform the way you write your sermon. There's this awareness, even in the Bible itself, that when we talk about things like death, like pain, like heaven, somehow it supersedes our ability to talk about them. And we have to communicate. The only way to communicate effectively about them is through song or through poetry or through image. Like it actually exceeds our abilities with words to actively communicate what we're trying to communicate here. And I love that it seems like even Jesus kind of runs out of words and just sort of breaks into song. So
interesting. It's a musical.
It's all Revelation, a musical. That's right. So
Apocalypse the musical.
That's, oh my gosh. Yes, you need to write that. I think the one pitfall, I know I've been going kind of long here, so I'll quit soon. But the one pitfall I will say is that this text has often been read ecologically in a way that says it doesn't matter what we do with the earth now because it's all just going to pass away. And I think the text itself resists that. It does say the old heaven and the old earth will pass away. But then it doesn't say, and we don't need them. It says, and a new heaven and a new earth will be given. There's really a sense of the fact that creation is a gift given by God to those who would receive it, especially non-human creation. And what Revelation is trying to do, remember, is not to pull you out of your suffering and say, it doesn't matter, it's fine. It's trying to help you live the best endurance you can in the midst of suffering. So I think our globe, I think our earth is suffering right now. And the question is not how can we pull ourselves away from that suffering, but how can we be ones who endure with the earth? How can we be ones who sort of metaphorically wipe away tears from the earth in a way that says, I acknowledge this pain, I see this suffering, and I'm here with you and working, you know, actively to comfort it. So don't preach this in a way that negates the gift that we have been given and the hope that God has for us that of what we will do with that gift.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I was actually going to ask you about that with this, because this text is sometimes used as a sort of biblical precedent for treating the earth however you want, because it's all just going to burn.
Right.
God's going to, you know, restart.
Right.
But I think, as you were saying, the emphasis here is not that the old heaven and earth are unimportant, but that they are so valuable to God that they are worth renewing. In the new age.
Yeah.
And so that's the ethos that is here, is how much God cares for heaven and earth.
Yes.
Enough to address the wrong, address the evil, and renew them.
Yeah.
For enjoyment.
I think that's a great point. And note where this is happening. Like, it's been very human focused up to this point. And at this point, the shift of attention goes away from the human. So it's not that like we're going to get a new stage for humans because humans broke the old ones. It's that redemption and new creation is for literally all of creation. not just humanity. Real quick, there's an article by Barbara Rossing, R-O-S-S-I-N-G, called For the Healing of the World, Reading Revelation Ecologically. So if y'all are interested in that, that would just be something to throw on your reading list.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
The only other thing that I would throw in here is just, we've mentioned this, but it's worth underscoring that what we're seeing here in this beautiful poetry is not brand new.
Yeah.
This is recalling the words of the biblical prophets. I was drawn especially to one of the last chapters of Isaiah 65, which reads, "For I am about to create a new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered or come to mind. I'm doing something new. I'm creating Jerusalem as a joy. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it or the cry of distress."
Yeah.
So John here is recycling ancient words for his own moment, his own time, in a way that shows continuity with his religious heritage or his faith tradition. And I think that also helps us to think through the way that this is not something brand new that's happening, but it's a renewal, something in continuity with what's come before.
Yeah. This is not a message for Christians because Jews messed things up. I'm going to just say it blatantly.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
You're a lot more gracious than I am.
Well, thanks, Rachel, for opening this section of the end of Revelation up to us. And folks, I think that's a good place for us to put a pause on this episode and give you a chance to come up with a sermon for your own congregation. Okay, thanks everyone for listening or watching this week. Just as a reminder, we're asking you to go to our YouTube channel and subscribe there. But you may also find us on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. You can contact us through any of the places where you find us, but you're also welcome to send us an email at firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com. And we're not done yet. We're near the end, but we're not there yet. So come back and hang out with us next time. Until then, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rachel Wren. Happy apocalypse.
Happy apocalypse.